Welcome, everyone. So tonight's question is not one that I get that often, but I have gotten it on occasion. And the question was, dear Sensei Tony, do you believe in angels? So often I get asked metaphysical questions. But it's an interesting one, and I will give you my opinion. So I thought in order to preface this, the reading tonight would be from Pete Townsend. I don't know about guardian angels. All I know about is staying alive. I can't shout about spiritual labels when little ones die and big ones cry. All I know is that I've been making it, and there have been many times that I didn't deserve to. Every show, there's been more faking it. But at the right moment, at the point of no return, somebody saves me again and again. Somebody saves me. I thank you, my friend. I like that. That song is from, it's called Somebody Save Me. And it's from the Empty Glass album, if any of you are interested. But I like that saying because, you know, Pete Townsend, the lead writer and performer with the band The Who, very spiritual guy. And part of this passage was in response to questions about his own spiritual practices and things like that. And I think that's a good place to start. It's from a place of humility. And it's from a place of not knowing. And I think before you go into any subject like this, I think it's important to start from that place where we ultimately begin with the humility of, I don't know. I want to know. I can bear witness to my experience, and I can act out of that practice of not knowing and bearing witness. So what I'm going to do tonight is bear witness out of that unknowing to the things that I have found and know. So the question is, what is an angel? So before I say whether I believe in an angel or not, we should define what that is. And it's a very interesting history. So the idea of there existing an intermediary realm between humans and the ultimate has seemingly always been there. Whether we look at it from an anthropological point of view and see it as the progression and various forms of theism, or if we look at it from a more psychological point of view, and the idea that the connection that we have to the ultimate is always personal. And even though it may be transpersonal in its transcendence, there's always, for humans, a very personal sense of that connection. So I think that either way you view it, it's coming from there. So everything I'm going to share with you tonight, you can understand from a psychological point of view or a metaphorical point of view and use it purely as that. Or you can do both. You can accept it from that point of view and accept the possibility of something beyond what we ordinarily might be able to define. So the most ancient culture we're aware of that has this sense of some sort of angelic realm, and the word angel, by the way, is translated pretty much as messenger. So when you think of angel, it has almost a hermetic, Hermes type of impression that it's the messenger of the divine. And the word in Sanskrit is deva. Now deva, D-E-V-A, deva, is the root of our word divine. And so devas were the ancient way to describe this realm of beings who served as messengers, guardians, intermediaries. When it came in, when that word diva came into the Greek language, it became known as daimon. D-A-I-M-O-N. So diva became daimon. And daimon was once again basically understood as this intermediary realm. The way which within which daimon was understood varied. So if we go to like Plato, let's say, Plato's view on the daimon was twofold. One, he saw the daimon as his higher self. Socrates saw the daimon as a way of talking about his true self. However, others would then see the daimon as some sort of, including Plato, as some sort of beings that were responsible for various things. They often stood in for natural things. So natural forces like earth, air, wind, and fire were represented by these elemental daimons. And they could be understood also as the souls of humans that had moved from the human realm into another, which is also the way that it was understood in the Sanskrit. So that's all fine and good. And then sometime after the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, and you see this in the Septuagint, one of their famous collection of writings, when they began to see all other faiths as evil, they begin to call them daimons. So the daimon of other people were evil. And that's where we get the change in the word slightly, demon. So the word demon was then popularly applied to any daimon who was not of the Jewish faith. So that's how we get this duality within that angelic realm. Originally, it didn't exist. Prior to the Babylonian captivity, even within the Jewish texts, it did not exist. And so this is something that happened after that experience. The word in Hebrew for angel is malak. And usually it's combined with another word, malak Adonai, malak Elohim, and it represents the idea that malak, this messenger, this angelic being, could either be speaking for God or could actually be representative of God. There are traditions that see the pre-existence of Christ as the angel Malak Adonai in the Hebrew scriptures. So it's a fascinating, fascinating study. And as I say, all of this stuff comes out of India and is influenced by Persia and so forth and so on. When we look at, so before I offer my opinion, when we look at the Buddhist view of angels, the Buddhist worldview, and again, no one has to take this literally, but it's an interesting metaphor, at the very least, was the idea that there were different realms of being. And in fact, that there was a trichilio cosmology, a trichilio cosmo, which meant that there were various levels of the universes, resulting in billions of galaxies, billions of cosmos, and that the idea within the Buddhist thinking was that the universe was infinitely large, it included not only these different realms, but it also included different dimensions. So let me give you those very briefly. So it was understood that there were realms that were lower and realms that were considered somewhat higher. And by that, they meant higher or lower in levels of sentience or self-awareness. So the lowest realm would be the hell realms. And the hell realms were where beings were very much unenlightened and suffering deeply because of that. The realm from there was the animal realm. And then the realm up from there was the human realm. And then the realm after that was known as the Asuras. And this realm is very interesting because this one is dominated by what we would probably call today aliens. So in the Buddhist cosmology, the Asuras represented an alien dimension to the universe. They even travel in spaceships sometimes. And they actually have a lot of similarities to our idea of the alien, you know, with the big eyes and that sort of thing. So it's very curious. People that love that sort of thing really kind of go off on tangents with that. But it is true. It is so. It is there. And in the realm above that are the devas, the angelic realm. So the understanding is that the consciousness of human beings has been on a journey of transmigration. In other words, it's having all these different experiences. It might experience a hell realm, an animal realm, the human realm, the Asura realm, or it might experience the Deva realm. And it gets pretty complex from there. And there's what I would call the Catholic version and the Protestant version of Buddhism. The Catholic version is very diverse and has so many different labels and layers and subcategories and so forth of all these different beings. And I would say the more Protestant or more simpler version has the ones that I described to you. Now, you have to understand very early on that there were some people who took this quite literally within the Buddhist tradition. They really believed there was an infinite cosmos that was very complex. And then even so, very early on, they applied all these teachings, whether they believed in them literally or not, psychologically. Because the most important thing to the Buddhist was always the psychological import. What does this mean for me psychologically? And what does this mean for me in terms of my own personal practice? So that's where I want to kind of go with this, because I think that that's the more useful part. The other part's really fun, and I'm happy to discuss that too. But let me lay it out this way. So, in the four directions system of mindfulness, which, you know, I lay out in my newest book and has been laid out in other versions, is our way of understanding the universal Dharma, the universal teachings of awakening. And in that, we have various mindfulness models that help us to learn different practices and to develop different insights that lead towards the ceasing of our psychological suffering. Now, this model that I'm going to use, we call the transpersonal model within the four directions. This model is fairly simple, and it can be viewed in two ways. One way is to view it from the side, so to speak. The other way is to view it from the top down. If we view it from the top down, this model resembles a solar system. At the center of the solar system, the sun, is what we call the true sun. Orbiting outside of that is what we would call the shadow aspect of the psyche. Orbiting beyond that is what we call the anima aspect of the psyche. And orbiting, finally, at the outer circumference is what we would call the ego self. And everything beyond this solar system is what we might define as other, the world. Now, we know ultimately all of this is one. So these are just skillful means to help us towards practice. Now, if you look at it from the side, it almost appears like a funnel. with the true self being the source, the next layer being the shadow, this layer being the anima, and this layer being the ego self, beyond what we might call the world. When we think of it this way, we can begin to then talk about things like angels from a psychological perspective. So if we go back to what the definition of an angel is, as being a messenger, a protector, a guide, then we can look at these different aspects of this model as presentations of that idea of angels. The first basic level of an angel would be the true self. Again, if we understand the angel, the diva or daimon, as actually our higher or true self. So that when we're in communication with our angel, this angel would be our true self. Now that's a very good, very succinct and very historically accurate way to talk about it. So one of the ways in which I do believe in angels is I like the language of the true self. Now again, the true self is a metaphor. All of it is actually one. But we use these different words to help us to get a handle on the various ways within which our psyche works. And we also might think of these various aspects, the true self, the shadow, the anima, as archetypes. You know, maybe using a Jungian interpretation, where the universe actually arises and these archetypes are part of our consciousness. However you view it, it's a very useful technique that's been used from ancient times in Buddhism. So that would be one way to talk about the angel. The shadow would be another way. Within Buddhist tradition, there is the understanding of angelic beings called Dharmapala. Dharmapala means the protector. It means those who protect the Dharma, or those who protect the practitioner of the Dharma. In the shadow realm, these are what are known as the wrathful or scary looking faces of the true self. And the most famous of these, linked in some ways to the language etymology, is Mahakala. Now Mahakala is the primary angelic being, and Mahakala is the great black one. His image, his visage is very fierce and frightening. He has horns, and he has a head mask full of skulls, five skulls. And he looks like he's very wrathful and very dangerous and very scary. And in fact, if you saw one of the paintings in Mahakala that are usually represented in tankas in the Tibetan tradition, you would think he was a demon, because that's how he appears. He appears like a devil. But if you understand it correctly, this shadow being is actually another face of the true self. And its wrathful vision is there to protect you and to cut off delusions. In Indian, another name for that is Achala or Akala, or it's also known in Japanese as Fudo, the Bodhisattva Fudo, who has the sword of discrimination that cuts through delusions in one hand and has a rope or chain that binds up neuroses with the other. And so it's a very powerful image that is meant to do what you find all the time in ancient writings. It is meant to really bring you up to clarity in a way that's very sobering. And that's why all these angelic beings always say, fear not. because they basically appear as wrathful beings, very dangerous, very powerful. So I think of the shadow aspect of the psyche as Maha. Another face of the true self, but a way of expressing this through the shadow. Now, what is the shadow? The shadow represents those aspects of our psyche that have not been integrated. So they are things that we have repressed, either because we couldn't face them, or perhaps we didn't understand them. But that energy and that material is very important, because it represents all the things that we have not brought into conscious awareness. And without going too far into the meaning of the shadow, because that could be a whole retreat, let alone a talk, suffice it to say that the shadow is where we experience grace. In the model of the four directions, the transpersonal model, the shadow represents grace, because it is in the darkness, it is in those places that sometimes are hidden, where everything about us, the things we don't want anyone else to know, the things that we'd be ashamed of to let people see, all of those things that society, polite society, really doesn't approve of, all those things exist in the shadow. So your darkest, darkest aspects of your being are there. But when you understand that the shadow is primarily another face of the true self, it is there you can turn for pure acceptance. Because within the shadow, there is no rejection. In the shadow, everything is accepted as it is. And that's why it's understood as the manifestation of grace in our lives. And that's why we begin our annual liturgy ceremony with the Sagahi, the feeding of the shadow, the hungry ghost. The next level up is the anima, which is the root of our word anime. And in this manifestation, or this angelic sense of things, is there to help us become creative and help us to not only experience the grace of the true self, but to create out of the true self. And this creative energy out of the true self, which is related to the second principle of oneness, is how we work with change to bring new things into being. So that is the meaning of the angelic being of the anima. Now, there are various ways within the Buddhist tradition, various names that these aspects have been given. As I said, the shadow has been called Mahakala. Anima has been referred to often as Kanzeon, or Kuan Yin, or Avalokiteshvara. And these archetypes, these Buddha and Bodhisattva archetypes, are there for us to be understood psychologically, mythologically, and for some people, cosmologically. So that's the layout from the Buddhist perspective. And it's also quite true that Buddhists believe that human beings may evolve into angelic beings, or what we might refer to as devas, or we might refer to as bodhisattvas of certain sorts, and that our role is to then move into this kind of manifestation so that we might become an energy that is able to help beings beyond just what we can do as humans. So it's kind of cool. Christmas time of the year, my favorite movie is This is a Wonderful Life. And the idea of humans evolving into angels really isn't found in the Christian or Hebrew scriptures. So a lot of those ideas came from the East and kind of infiltrated their way in. So I always think of that as being much more of a Buddhist idea. So there's the layout. And I could go further and talk about the four directions and the four wisdom kings and the center being Amida and the crown of Amida being Kanzeon and the manifestation of the crown, the protector, being Mahakala or Fudo. And it's all quite beautiful and very useful from a metaphoric point. But what's my personal belief? Because that was the question. Do I believe in angels? Well, I would definitely affirm I believe in angels in the way I've been describing, psychologically. But do I believe in something beyond that? Well, it's hard for me to talk about that because for me, everything is mind. So if I talk about an experience that I have, I can talk about it psychologically. But that doesn't mean I'm limiting that definition to just the realm of the brain. Like Pete Townsend, I sometimes hesitate to talk about guardian angels when little ones die and big ones cry. But I'll be quite honest with you. I have had powerful experiences since the time I was a boy. And these experiences for me have left their mark. And so I would have to deny my experiences to say that I have not had contact with what I would call angelic beings. And one in particular. Now, a lot of people might find that strange, being that I'm a scientific fellow. But part of science for me is questioning everything. And I bear witness to my experiences. And as I laid out earlier, I'm quite happy talking about it in terms of psychology. But I have had very powerful experiences that I can't deny. When I was a very young boy, I had the experience of someone, something out there, watching over me. Now, again, could be pure illusion on the part of this small boy, but it had a definite shape and form, and it was frightening to me at first. It was dark. It seemed more malevolent than benevolent, and yet, it did not ever feel to me that it was malevolent. It felt protective. It felt illuminating. And at one point in my teenage years, I actually had the experience of hearing such a being. I'm really putting myself out there today. And this changed my hearing. From the time that I heard this expression, my ears began to ring slightly, and it's never gone away. Now, I had a vision of this shape and a name, and this is before I knew all this stuff. And the name was Malak. And I never really thought much of it, except this is some kind of weird experience I've had. Maybe I'm going a little crazy, but I've had this real experience. And it's been there for me. When I almost froze to death, that I talk about in the book, up on the mountain there above Bedford, I had the sense of this being present. And the presence of this being at times has manifested in a way that even those other than me have experienced. But the wildest thing about this, and this is what I'll leave on, was when I met one of my teachers. When I first met my Tibetan teacher, Khonchak Gyaltsa, on the temple at the top of Gampel State Park Mountain. When we met, he said not a word to me, but just giggled. He took me by the hand and led me into the temple. And then he took me downstairs to a subterranean area. And before me was this huge space with a large curtain drawn across it. And again, not saying a word to me, He drew back the curtain, pointed at the altar space, and laughed. And there, in a tanka or painting about 10 feet high, was Mahakala. So say what you will about those experiences, but this led my teacher to believe that I had been a part of this tradition before this life. And so how do you explain those things? I don't know. But I honor them two ways. One, I honor them psychologically. What's the meaning of it? Because that's the most important thing. How does it help relieve suffering? But I have to tell you that I treasure it personally as an experience. So there's my long answer to, do you believe in angels? So I'll be curious to know what your thoughts are on that subject.